This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Good evening, welcome to Night Transmissions. This is episode number 34. I need to remember to tell you what episode it is because of the show notes. You see, I have show notes at the website, which is www.nighttransmissions.com. And if you don't know what the show number is, it might be a little bit hard to look it up. The first show tonight is a 1957 broadcast of ABC Mystery Theater. It's a short story, My Adventure in Norfolk, written by A.J. Allen, which was a pseudonym for a man who had a really pretty interesting career. For more of that, drop by the website and check out the show notes on show 34. See, I said it again.
It's mystery time. Time now for the best in mystery. Tonight, Mystery Classics stars Sir Ralph Richardson in My Adventure in Norfolk. Sir Ralph Richardson, and Mystery Time presents him now, transcribed in the adventure classic My Adventure in Norfolk by A.J. Allen.
Well, I don't know how it is with you, but 4 or 5 weeks after the new year, my wife always says to me, "Have you thought about where we shall go in August?" And of course I always say no. And then she starts looking through advertisements of bungalows to let. But it happened last year as usual, and I had forgotten all about it, as usual. Until one very foul morning in February, it was snowing like a barnstormer's production of East Lynne. Margaret looked up from her letters at breakfast and said,
"I think it's the very place."
"Uh-huh."
"The man seems very civil, too."
"Oh, good. You know, if you ask me, the government will never get this new bill through."
"It's in Norfolk, a place called Hickling Broad."
"Eh? What is?"
"But this bungalow, of course, I told you. It's furnished, too, with boathouse, garden, and garage."
Seems hardly possible."
"And painted linen. He says we can go and see it and stay the night. He'll arrange for a woman to come in and oblige."
"No, just a minute. I remember now. Isn't that the place with the exorbitant rent?"
"Yes, but you'll have to talk to him about that. He's bound to come down. They always do."
"My experience is they always don't."
"You're never firm enough. Anyway, we can go down on Thursday and stay the night."
"What? In this weather?"
"It may be beautiful by then. You know what the weather is this time of year."
Between then and Thursday, the weather did everything it does at any time of the year. But when the train battled its way into Potter Heigham Station, and we stood shivering on the platform, it was settled again, snowing hard. Fortunately, the car I'd ordered was waiting, and the 5-mile drive to the bungalow, which seemed to be in the most desolate spot on earth, was accomplished with no more than average hazard. I was apprehensive in case the woman who was to oblige should have proved disobliging, but my fears were groundless. Although it was late and dark when we arrived, we found fires burning, and she'd even cooked us a steak apiece.
"Sophia, sure you'll be all right now, sir. I'll be getting along home. I can catch the last bus at the top of the lane."
"Oh, thank you, Mrs. Selson. Oh, we'll be quite happy now."
Hope that steak's all right. I asked the butcher to pick it out special.
Oh, very nice, thanks. It's knives probably need sharpening.
I'd stay if my husband was all right. But it was a nasty operation, and if I denied it, I'd be a liar. If I was to tell you what they'd done to him, you'd hardly believe
it. I'm sure it must have been very trying. Well, if you must go, Mrs. Selston.
Messy, that's what it was. And the dressing. Why, every night I have to... Are you sure that steak's nice, Mum? You've hardly touched it.
I don't think I feel very hungry after all.
Now, look here, we mustn't let you miss your bus, Mrs. Selston. I'll light you to the door.
Oh, thank you, sir.
You know, I rather like this oil lamp business myself. It's not so stark as electricity. Ah, not snowing much now, I see. Well, thank you very much for coming in. We'll be seeing you in the morning.
That's all right, sir.
Now, I can't think why they always refer to that type of woman as homely. Nursing homely would be a better description. What, tired, dear?
I am, rather. It's been a long day.
Yes. I think bed's indicated. I tell you what, you go up. There's enough fire left in the bedroom for you to undress by. I'll boil a kettle and bring you up a hot water bottle. Mrs. Ting's left two enormous stone ones in the kitchen.
I think I will go up if you don't mind. Feel most dreadfully tired quite suddenly. I expect to see a reaction after rushing about all day.
Yes, and the complete absence of any noise leaves you in a sort of vacuum. It's a quiet place, please. I don't think I've heard a sound since we arrived. Well, that's funny.
What is?
That car, just as I said there. What, is it a car?
I didn't hear anything.
Oh. Well, that's important, then. I tell you what is funny. The way we speak of going up to bed. Well, there isn't any up. This is a bungalow. You go southeast to bed, or is it northwest? Anyway, off you go, dear. I won't be long with your bottle. When Margaret had gone, I put the kettle over the fire and lit my pipe. The kettle started singing away. And as it hadn't been any competition, it sounded like a mass choir. On one of its downward cadences, I thought I heard the car again. I took the kettle off for a minute to listen. But there was nothing. Not that it mattered if there had been a car. Did you know how it is? When everything's very quiet, you give every little noise its full value. Well, I put the kettle back and had a look out of the window. It was pretty dark, but with that sort of luminous darkness that you get with the snow. And then, down the road, beyond the bungalow and behind some trees that bordered the road, I saw a light. I didn't want to bother Margaret, so I crept along the hall and opened the front door quietly.
What's that?
Oh, sorry, me, dear. I'm just going to pop out for a minute.
Whatever for? I thought you were coming to bed.
Well, I am. Just a tick. Just want to put the nose out first.
Do mind what you're doing. You'll fall into a drift or something.
Well, actually, I fell into an adventure. I suppose you could call it that. When I got out, the cause of the radiance was obvious. It was the light of a car, one of those square box-looking saloons with a flat radiator about the size of a small hotel. What was more interesting was there was a girl tinkering with the engine, quite an attractive girl as far as I could see, too. But she was pretty well muffled up with fur, so I couldn't be quite sure. Oh, good evening. Anything I can do?
Oh, thank you. I don't really know what's the matter. Just stopped.
Ooh, smells hot, doesn't it? Are there any water in the radiator?
No, I expect so. There always is water in radiators, isn't there?
Oh, I see your point. It depends whether anyone's remembered to put some in. Let's have a look, shall we? Hmm. I can't see any. By Jove, she is hot. You know, we better get some water in there. I can get some from my garage.
Couldn't we use snow?
Oh, better not. Now, hold on a jiffy. I'll get a bucket. By the time I got back to the bucket of water, she'd found a funnel. And so I poured a little water into the radiator. Oh, look out now. Oh, talk about volcanoes. I'd even blown the funnel out. Well, let me see if I can turn the engine over.
Well, I couldn't move it.
I'll have a go. Oh, come on up, you brute. No, it's no good. It feels solid. I can't move it an inch.
But it's no good. I must get on.
But my dear girl, it's miles to anywhere.
I can't help that. I tell you, I've got to... What's that?
What's what?
That noise.
That sounds like another vehicle coming. But if it comes this way, you can get a tow, or at least a lift to a more acceptable route. I can see its light. It's a long way off, though. You know, you can see for miles in this flat country. It struck me the girl didn't seem to be as pleased as she ought to have been. But as the lights and the sound of the engine got nearer, she was at first uneasy, then plainly scared.
Hello there.
What's up, girl? Skidding? Oh, back down, have you?
Well, this lady has. Pretty completely, too. She's seized up solid. I mean, the car has. I wonder if you could help with a tow or a lift.
Well, I'm going to Norwich. I could give the lady a lift that far if she liked. But what about the car?
Well, I tell you what. If you could give me a hand, we could push it into the garage for tonight. There's no car in it. And then, if you could send for it in the morning, but not too late, though, because I'm going to London.
Suppose it will have to do.
Well, a little gratitude on her part would have been more gracious. Well, the lorry driver, whose name turned out to be Williams, helped me push the car into the garage, and a tough job it was. It was heavy, for one thing, and the body and the wings were slippery in the snow and ice. The girl made no attempt to help. She just fussed around as though she thought we might run off with the beast at him. And she seemed a bit calmer when it was safely in with the doors locked. As we walked away from the garage, I suddenly realized how cold it was.
Safe enough there, miss. No one can start it anyway.
Oh, no. Oh, it's cold. You know, you two ought to come in and have a drink before you start.
Oh, but
well,
I
don't mind if I do, sir.
Oh, I won't take a minute. It'll warm you both this way.
I'll come in a jiffy, sir. I'd better move me lolly out in the middle of the road in case anything else comes along. Don't want something up the back of it.
I took the girl in and sat her by the sitting room fire. And then I went out again to show Williams the way in. I met him by the gate.
Lady and friend of yours, sir?
Never seen her before in my life.
If you ask me, sir, there's something fishy about her. What's a young lady driving round at night in this weather alone for?
I mixed three whiskies and water. There wasn't any soda. I took my first opportunity to study the girl. But she's a bit older than I thought, and she treated us with a lack of friendliness. Well, we'd done nothing to deserve it. There's a very hostility and suspicion, which was rather hard lines on us, considering. And she kept dodging out of the light. It struck me as odd. She hurried Williams over his drink in a rather foolish way, in view of the fact that he was the driver. But when he'd gone to start the engine, I asked her if she was all right for money, and apparently she was. Well, I reminded her to send early for the car, and she said she would, and off they went. You asleep, dear?
Mm-hmm. No. I believe I dozed for a minute. Why did you go out?
Yes. I thought I heard something, and I went down to see. I was right to it. It was a car broken down outside, and the girl all on her own. I gave her a drink, but she wouldn't stop. She's gone off to Norwich in a lorry.
The girl wouldn't stop. Where's her car?
We've shoved it in the garage.
But you must have been gone for hours. Why didn't you wake me up?
I told her about it and the way the girl had acted and how she'd been anxious to get away. Then Margaret said something which made me think.
I think the whole thing's most peculiar.
Peculiar? Well, funny you should say that. The lorry chap said it was fishy. Look here. Where did she come from? This is an unimportant road. Not one you'd normally take.
No, unless you were avoiding people. If you were driving a stolen car, for instance.
A stolen car? Well, I never thought of that.
You wouldn't. It was a girl.
If it was stolen,
sight, Joe. I'm going to have another look at that car. No, don't you move. I'll slip out and I'll look at it again. That car may hold the clue to the whole fishy business. It was very dark outside and so still that the candle I carried burnt without a flicker. It wasn't a large garage, and the car nearly filled it. We backed it in so that it would be easier to tow out. Not the sort of car I'd pinch. That engine's still warm. Well, I've seen the engine. There are no clues there. Now, if I can squeeze along the wall, I can get a peep in at the back. Hello, frosted windows. Oh, no, of course not. It's Ralph, Ralph. I wonder if there's room to open the door. Of course, it would open away from me. Hey, don't shove. You're pinning me against the wall. I didn't know anyone was there. Good heavens. He wasn't pushing. He was as dead as a doornail. When I got over my first shock, I managed to bundle the body back into the car and have a look at it. It was the body of a tall man with a moustache and evidently been propped up on the floor against the door so that as soon as I opened the door, it had slumped out. He was tall and thin, dark, dressed in tweeds and a raincoat. No papers in the pocket. There was a note case with £9 in it. No tailor's name on the clothes, nothing whatever to give any clue of his identity. But it was obvious why he was dead. There was a bullet hole under his right shoulder blade. Someone had shot him from behind, and I guessed the bullet had gone through into the lung. Well, what was I to do? There was no phone in the house. The nearest police station was probably miles away, and I had no transport. Besides, there was Margaret. I couldn't stroll off and leave her alone. There was no night to drag her around with me, round the countryside. In the end, I shut the car door again, carefully locked up the garage, and went to bed.
What on earth have you been doing? What an age you've been.
I'm sorry, sorry, darling, sorry.
Well, did you find anything?
Yes, I found something in the back of the car.
What was it?
I found £9.
£9? In the back of the car?
Yes, in the back of the car. In a wallet.
Oh, how extraordinary. She must have forgotten all about it.
Yes. I wonder if she did.
Well, how do you mean?
I was just wondering.
What did you do with it?
Well, I left it there. I thought it was best. After all, it's none of my business. But there's nothing we can do about it now, is there?
No.
No. Well, then. Let's go to sleep.
Good night. I'm so tired.
The next thing I knew, it was broad daylight and 9 a.m. Mrs. Selson was due at 10, so I tumbled out pretty quickly. I wanted to have another look at the car and the body in daylight. Unfortunately, I think the mention of the £9 had roused my wife's curiosity, and she insisted on coming to the garage with me. Now, look here, dear. I didn't tell you last night, but, well, there's something rather more to this than I said. You'll have to be prepared for a bit of a shock.
A shock? Why? What else is there?
Well, you see, the...
But there's no car here at all. The garage is empty.
I've never had such a shock in my life. No car, no body, nothing. There was a patch of grease on the floor where I dropped the candle, but otherwise there was nothing to show that I'd ever been in there. Another queer thing, there were no wheel marks. Either in the garage or outside, so it had apparently snowed very heavily again and covered them up. It didn't look as though there'd been all that snow. Margaret was inclined to laugh at the whole thing. We went back to the house, and she got some breakfast.
You might have believed, Vincent, you sat by the fire after I'd gone to bed, dozed, and dreamt the whole thing. There never was any car or girl. Wishful thinking, probably.
And did I dream going out to the garage again and finding the £9?
I don't know, but you must admit that...
Wait a minute. Look here, the glasses.
The glasses?
Yes. I said I gave them a drink, didn't I? Well, if the glasses are there, that proves it. I was in that drawing room like a shot. The glasses were there, three of them, just as they'd left them. So I had been right. But I still didn't say anything about the body. The mystery was quite mysterious enough already. Besides, an idea was forming at the back of my mind, and I wasn't ready to talk about it.
But if there was a car and a girl came back and took it, how did she do it without waking them? Well, the garage is so close to the house, and we're not heavy sleepers.
She couldn't have done it alone anyway. It wouldn't have started. So it had to be either towed or pushed, neither of which could be done by one person.
What are you going to do with that glass? Why have you wrapped it in your handkerchief?
I'm going to take it away with me. I didn't say a word to Mrs. Selston about our night's fun and games, but I settled up with her, and soon after that, our previously ordered car came to drive us to the station. On the way, I called on the landlord of the bungalow and told him we'd let him know about taking it. Neither Margaret nor I could make up our minds just then whether we wanted to see the place again or not. I had the girl's glass with me, carefully packed in that biscuit tin. And when we reached Liverpool Street... Taxi?
Yeah, it's all right, sir.
All right. Scotland Yard. I was lucky. My friend Inspector Gregson was in. He even seemed quite pleased to see me. Well, I didn't tell him the story to begin with. It seemed a bit thin in broad daylight. But I brought out the glass and I asked him if he could test it for prints and identify them. Well, he was a bit amused, but Gregson's a sport and he knows me. Well, his chap's awfully quick on the job, and it wasn't long before one came back and laid a file on the desk in front of the inspector. Gregson thumbed it through for a bit, and then he looked up and grinned at me.
Well, Alan, you know your little lady right enough. I've got a picture of her here, too. Here, is that the damsel you're looking for?
Yes, that's her, by Jove, yes. Who is she?
Oh, she's had lots of names at different times, but her last one was Naomi Sterling. She was in twice for shoplifting, but that was early in her career. Later on, she took up with the leader of a very well-known race gang, one of the nastiest pieces of work we've had in this country. Here, there's a picture of him, too. Here it is.
Good Lord, the body.
What?
It doesn't matter for a minute, no. Go on. What? Do you know any more about these people?
Yes, quite a bit. This race gang fell foul of another gang, and there was a bit of a scrap. Naomi's boyfriend, he was known as Smug, got shot dead in the fight. When Naomi managed to get him away in a car, the car broke down. Somewhere in Norfolk, I believe.
But Gregson, look here. Oh, well, go on.
Well, it seems that she left the car and the dead man in a garage belonging to some simple oaf that she'd kidded into helping her. Anything the matter, Ellen?
No, nothing. No, go on.
Well, she left it in this garage and got a lift in a blue lorry that was going to Norwich. Only she never got there.
Oh, I see. Well, you knew all about this, and you picked her up on the way.
No, we didn't. We didn't know about it until afterwards. Apparently, the lorry was being driven pretty furiously in the snow, and it skidded on a bend and hit a wall. Naomi and the driver, a chap named Williams, were thrown out and ran their heads against the wall. And that, in case you don't know, is a very, very fatal thing to do. Anyhow, it was in their case. Were you gaping like a fish for, don't you believe me?
Yes. No, I mean, look here, Gregson. I know you chaps are pretty smart, but how on earth can you know all this and have it there in black and white? There hadn't been time. It only happened last night.
Last night? Last night, my foot. It happened 4 years ago this February. And the people we're talking about have been dead for 4 years. Great Scott, Alan, what's the matter? You look as though you'd seen a ghost.
that was the end of my adventure in Norfolk. But just think of it. I could have stuck to that 9,000.
I like that one. If you're like me, you would think, oh, well, that's an okay variant on the Ghost of the Hitchhiker. A little different, slightly different perspective. But I just love how, at the end, his main concern is that he could have kept the 9 pounds. Did you notice that when the car had stalled, did you notice the way the narrator spoke about it? How it felt completely frozen solid. Is this a crank automobile? How old is this short story? Before I listened to this, I had never really heard of My Norfolk Adventure. I had never heard of A.J. Allen. I did know that there was a good possibility that the radio play was based on an older story. And the comments about trying to turn the engine over made me think this must be a story from early in the century. And it is. The story was originally published in 1918. It occurs to me that some of you may not know what I mean by a hand crank, an engine. It used to be possible to start a car in a manner not completely unlike you sometimes see people starting lawnmowers, you know, where they put their foot on the lawnmower and they pull a cord and the lawnmower starts up. Well, these old cars did not use ropes to start them, but a hand crank. Maybe a better analogy is kick-starting a motorcycle. The only car with a hand crank that I ever had any sort of personal experience with was I don't really remember. It was the car that belonged to my brother. And it was, I suppose, like a 37 or 38. But I do remember that this particular car had kind of a little bit recessed in the grill, a receptacle for a hand crank. And the hand crank had a socket that would fit over this receptacle, and you would grab a hold of it, and you would use this hand crank to turn the engine over manually. Why would you want to do this? Well, the earliest automobiles had no starter. It didn't take too long for people to figure out that a starter's a good idea. But for quite a while after that, I think really until the 60s, cars would still have the capability of being started by a hand crank. And a few cars provided for this option, including this old, I think it was a Buick that my brother owned. I only saw him use it once, I think. I mean, he had a battery and a starter and everything, but one day his battery was dead, and he got out the hand crank. He went around to the front of the car and jerked on the hand crank, and by God, the car started up. He also darn near broke his arm, because once the car started up, the hand crank would be spinning madly. So you had to be careful when starting a car with a hand crank. Anyway, that's enough history lesson for now, I guess.
Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with a case I call the Kidnap Caper. I was shocked to learn that a wealthy industrialist named Quigley had been kidnapped. Mrs. Quigley asked me to investigate when she received a strange ransom note in her husband's handwriting. It said to have their son John bring $200,000 in small bills to a nearby park at 10 o'clock that night. But we don't have a son named John, Mrs. Quigley told me. Very interesting, I said. I believe Mr. Quigley's trying to tell us something. I had a hunch the letters J-O-H-N were a code corresponding to numbers. The phone number where Quigley was held. The hunch was right. This is Ellery Queen with a case I call the Rocking Chair Fraud. A museum aide approached me to authenticate an item being considered for the early American wing of the museum. It was a very crude wooden hobby horse that was purported to have been the inspiration for Benjamin Franklin's invention of the rocking chair. What does the seller want for this antique hobby horse, I asked. The aide replied, really more than we want to pay. Then don't, I said. It's a fake. The first hobby horse wasn't made until around 1800. Franklin died in 1790. Pretty difficult to get inspired when you're cold in the grave.
Well, that's the first 30 minutes, and we're going to have a break here. But we'll be back real soon. Next up is a very well done story from the Black Mass for November the 30th of 1970. Give this a listen. I think you'll like it. I certainly did.
Welcome to the Black Mass. Tonight, a ghost story by Ambrose Bierce. Here is The Moonlit Road.
I haven't touched your tea, Mr. Stephen. Shall I warm it?
Don't fuss, Ellen. Please don't fuss.
Sherry, then.
No, I have it here.
Well, this pill'll be more comfortable.
Oh, Ellen, stop. I'm not helpless yet. What you can do is close the terrace window. There's a draft again.
Oh, Mr. Stephen, but the window's closed. There's no draft, not from here.
Not open? But I feel. Oh, yes, well, never mind, then.
It's a chill you have, Mr. Steve. And I'm going to have Billy fetch Dr. Benson.
For God's sake, stop, Ellen. Stop it. Get Billy to stoke up the fire, and that's all. Now, let me alone.
Yes, sir.
No? Not a draft? Well, they'll have the house to themselves now, soon enough. As you can see, I am the most unfortunate of men. I am rich, and I am respected, and well-educated, and until just recently of sound health. I am the only child of Joel and Julia Hetman. My father was a well-to-do country gentleman. His wife, my mother, was a beautiful and obedient woman, to whom he was passionately attached with what I now can suspect was a jealous and exacting devotion. The details that I can relate hardly add up to a story. Indeed, they could fit together in any number of ways. I've imagined all sorts, with feelings so opposed that they've worn down finally to no feeling at all. Doesn't matter now. It ought never to have mattered. Briefly, then, I was a student at Yale. One day, I received a telegram from my father of such urgency that, in compliance with its unexplained demand, I left at once for home. Father? Father?
Stephen. Stephen, this way. Stephen, it's terrible to have to tell you this way.
Well, tell me, for God's sake, what is it?
Your mother. It's your mother, Stephen.
What's happened? She's ill. Dying. Father, now what's happened?
She's dead, Stephen.
But how?
Murdered. Barbarously murdered.
Murdered? Why? Who?
We don't know. We don't know. We don't know anything. I had gone to Nashville. I didn't expect to be back before the following afternoon. There was a complication, and I returned home the same night. It was late, nearly dawn. I found I had no latchkey. I didn't want to wake the servant, so I walked around to the back. I don't know why, the doors were always locked. But to my surprise, the back door was open. It was standing open, as if someone had just used it. I entered and went upstairs to your mother's room. In the darkness, I stumbled over. I'll spare you the details, save to say that she was already dead. Strangulation.
But why? Was anything taken from the house?
No, nothing. So far as we could see.
But what about the servants? Hadn't they heard any sound?
No, nothing.
And the assassin? Is there no trace of him?
No, nothing. But those terrible finger marks on her throat. Dear God, that I may forget them.
I gave up my studies and remained with my father. He was greatly changed. He had always been of a sedate, taciturn disposition. Now he had fallen into so deep a dejection that nothing could hold his attention. Yet anything could arouse him to a fitful interest. A footfall, a sudden entrance, one might have called it an apprehension.
Hey, who's there? Who is it?
It's only me, Father.
Oh, come in. Well, don't stand there in the dark that way.
Shall we take a walk this evening?
No. No, the garden's chilly, and I'm tired. I think I'll go to my room directly.
I worry about you, Father. I know that this whole thing has been terrible for you, but you've become too melancholy. Have you taken to sleepwalking as well?
Sleepwalking? Why?
Last night. Didn't you enter my room? I heard steps along the hall, and then my door opened. Someone stood there in the doorway. I thought it was you, and I called out. When I turned on the light, you'd gone. Got to the door only soon enough to see your door closing down the hall. Wasn't it you, Father? Can you remember?
No, it wasn't me. It must have been your mother. She worries if you come in. Yes, I remember. She got up during the night and then came back. Well, she couldn't have. Stephen, what are you trying to do?
Do?
Isn't it bad enough for me now? Must you make things worse with your fantasies, your imagining?
Well, it might have been a servant.
Must have been Ellen. She's always doting over you.
Well, I only wondered that it... Well, if it wasn't you, it might have been...
What do you mean?
Well, I mean that the assassin might have returned, might still be in the house.
That's nonsense. Nonsense.
Why? He's never been found. He's still somewhere.
Yes, I suppose.
Father, have you told me everything that happened that night?
Of course. What else? Why do you ask?
Because it doesn't make sense. Mother was adored by everyone. She was the kindest woman who ever walked the earth. No sane creature could possibly want to hurt her.
Sane? Why do you say sane?
Father, did she have a lover?
Stephen.
Was that it? Is that who opened the back door that night you came back from Asheville? Are you hiding that from me to save her memory?
Oh, stop!
He might have done it. I could imagine that. Mother loved you. I know that. She was devoted to you. She'd never have been unfaithful. But she was kind to everyone. I can imagine his jealousy. His fury at her refusing him.
Stephen, stop this.
Well, what did happen?
She was murdered. Isn't that enough?
Enough? Yes. But is it enough for her? Is she still here in this house? Does she haunt us, searching for her lover or her murderer? Does she blame us, Father?
Stephen, let it alone. For God's sake, let it alone.
I never saw her, but I was convinced that her ghost walked the house. The terrible cold of the presence of the dead was everywhere. Perhaps he saw her. I could not. But there were moments at night.
Stephen. Oh, Stephen.
Mother?
Stephen.
The iciness of the grave. The smell of decay. No. I won't see your cat. But I imagine I saw her face, hideous, white with hate, rotting, rotting. No, no, go away. I am not your assassin. I am not your assassin. One night, a few months later, my father and I were returning home from our evening walk. A full moon was high above the horizon, and the road, save for the black shadows at the bordering trees, was a ghostly white. As we approached the gate of our dwelling, my father suddenly stopped. He clutched my arm. Father, what's the matter?
There, what is that?
I see nothing, Father.
There, the gate, directly ahead.
There's nothing, Father. Come on now, we'd better go in.
No. You're ill. Now go away. Go away.
Father, what do you see?
No, Julia, no. No.
I tried to follow him, but for some reason couldn't move from the spot.
Go away.
The chill had touched my face.
Julia.
It was all about me.
Julia.
I couldn't turn my head.
No, leave me alone. Leave me alone.
When I turned to look for my father, he was gone. And in all the years that have passed, no whisper of his fate has reached me. I remain here, my youth of brilliant parts and promise faded, its life-blood drained, sifted into the darkness and the silence of this house. Voices seek me out. I hear them not, but only doubt. Doubt, and emptiness.
Drink up. Drink up. Tomorrow. Today, I suppose you say I was alive. Alive. And tomorrow. Well, there's no tomorrow, no yesterday. There's nothing beyond that forest, those trees. That's all I can remember back to, forest. 20 years ago, I came out of a forest. Made my way across the country, all the way to this place. Well, that was something. That was something. I didn't even know my name. I called myself Casper. Casper. Everyone wants to know, what's your name? In this world, everyone must have a name. It prevents confusion, even when it does not establish our identity. Casper prevented confusion and spent 20 years trying to find a comfortable way to die. There's some small light, though, of a past. I don't believe it. I can't believe it.
That's the only thing that seems like a recollection. Even if it's wrong or confused, the only thing I have of that life. Two scenes that play over and over. First, there's a house, a big house, owned by a prosperous planter. There's a woman, a beautiful woman, like a child. And a boy, their son, he's a vague figure, never clear, usually not there at all. The father loves the wife terribly, but he's tortured by a fear that she doesn't belong to him. He can't seem to believe her devotion, her love. And he's reduced to vulgar and commonplace ways of testing her. One day, he goes to the city. He tells her, I'll be gone till the next afternoon. But I'll come back that night and go to a rear door that I had left unlocked. It's dark all around the house. But as I approach, I hear something. The door is open. And a figure. A man. I thought it was a man. I feared it was a man. Sometimes now I can't even believe it was human. He headed straight for me. Then just disappeared in the dark. I didn't know where to chase him. So intensely did my jealousy and rage fill me, I didn't search. I rushed into the house, and up the stairs, to her room, and I pushed open her door. I saw the bed, vaguely, the covers tossed about. I went to it, empty. She was gone, escaped. Or hiding. I looked about in the darkness. Walked straight to a corner where she knelt against the wall. I could see her face, the terror in her eyes, the guilt. Ah! My hands were at her throat. I kneeled on her struggling body, and there in the darkness, I strangled her till. She was dead. No, it never happened. It never happened. I don't believe it. Oh, I was possessed. Possessed by something or someone. But it's all I have. It's all that comes from me. And I go over it again and again. Now, there's another scene. Another dream. Another vision of the night. I stand among shadows along a moonlit road. Someone is with me. I cannot see who. But there's another presence. Head. Where the road ends at a gate. In the shadow of the large house. I catch the gleam of white garments. Then the figure of a woman. Before me on the road. My wife. Julia. Murdered. Death in the face. Marks on the throat. Eyes are fixed on mine with an infinite sadness. Sadness, not hate, not menace, but the apparition terrifies me, still terrifies me. She still reaches out to me here. No. Oh.
Dream up. This does it. Wipes it out. Wipes it out. For a little while. For a little while.
Stephen.
No. No, go away. I'm not your assassin.
It's no use. And it only confuses me why he's so fearful. He doesn't see me. He never saw me. I can't imagine what he would see now. But fear has no sense at all. It's crazy. Just crazy. It makes horrible things out of those who want only kindness and some peace. I keep wandering among these scenes, these rooms, in search of something that just doesn't matter anymore, what really happened. No one seems to know. Joel's gone, and there's only Stephen left for a little while. Stephen's my son, who wasn't here at the time. He was away at college. Joel wasn't here either. He'd gone to Nashville on some business and was staying the night. I had retired early and fallen into a peaceful sleep, but then I awoke. The house seemed more than usually quiet. I had a strange sense of danger, of something. Well, not that I was afraid of being alone. I was often alone, but this was different. There was a chill, as one waits for a thing long imagined or feared, and the feeling grew as I lay there. I felt as if I were lying straight and cold in my coffin, the white satin around my head, the smell of dried flowers, a little bouquet I held in my hand. I wanted to pull my fingers apart, but couldn't, as in a dream. No. No. I strained for some sign of life in me. And then... oh. I could feel my heart pounding. It was a dream. I sat up in the dark and listened. My own heart was the only sound at first. I listened and... after a while, I wondered if the beating came from inside me or somewhere else. I tried to hear which. And then, as if my own fears had decided, had reached out into the dark house and began to assemble some figure, something. I heard it first on the stairway from the back entrance just below my room. A soft, irregular sound of footfalls on the stairs. It was slow, hesitant, uncertain, as of something that did not see its way. To my disordered reason, all the more terrifying for that, as the approach of some blind and mindless malevolence to which there is no appeal. I said that fear has no brains, it's an idiot. But this had a growing purpose. It can shape as it approached. It approached my door. And then... stood there. I heard the breath. He hesitated, his hand on the door. Then it turned and went away, down the stairs, hurriedly. As if in sudden fear, I rose to call for help. But hardly had my shaken hand found the doorknob when... I heard it returning. It ran up the stairs, shaking the house. I fled to a corner of the room, crouched on the floor. I tried to cry out. I tried to call Joel, my husband, but suddenly it was in the room, searching me out. Oh, It had gone to the bed and stopped there and turned and came directly to me. I felt a strength of clutch upon my throat. I beat feebly against something that bumped backward. I felt my tongue thrust itself and then I passed into this life. No, I have no knowledge of what it was. The sum of what we know at death is the measure of what we know afterwards. No new light falls upon any page of it. In memory is written all that we can read. We hide in the dark and peer out into the dim light of the present and the fading past. But there is one more scene. A night. We know when it is night. Well, then you retire to your houses, and we can venture from our places of concealment to move unafraid about our old home. To look in at the windows, even to enter rooms and gaze upon your faces as you sleep. I could see my husband Joe, then Stephen. How strange they looked, how lone. Had they loved me after all? They were saddened and aged by my departure. I tried so often to make them see me, some way to let them know I was here, and send them my great love and pity. But always if I dared approach or wake them in their sleep, they would turn toward me the terrible eyes of the living, frightening me, and I would hesitate. As if my hand was now upon the door, and turn away. On this night I had searched for them, but they were nowhere in the house. I looked about the moonlit lawn, and then moved in the white light along the path to the gate. Suddenly I saw them on the road. They had stopped walking and were looking toward the house. I heard their voices. They stood in the shadow of a group of trees. They stood near, so near. Their faces were turned toward me. And Joel's eyes were fixed on mine. He saw me. At last he saw me. All my terror and hesitation was gone. He sees, he will understand. I moved forward, smiling and consciously beautiful, to offer myself to his arms, to comfort him, to speak words that would restore the broken bonds between the living and the dead. Joel. But his face went white with fear. His eyes were those of a hunted animal.
Leave me alone.
He backed away and ran right into the woods. He never returned. Maybe he died, wanders about some other place as I do here. And Stephen, poor Stephen, is left even more alone. I've never been able to make him know that I'm here, watching him, longing to care for him as a mother should. But soon he too must pass to this life invisible and be lost to me. Lost.
Oh, lost. Mr. Stephen, but the window's closed. There's no draft, not...
That was The Moonlit Road by Ambrose Bierce. The part of Julia was played by Norma Jean Wanvik. Stefan was Martin Ponch. Ellen was played by Nancy Ponch. And Joel was played by your host of The Black Mass, Eric Bauerfeld. The technical production was by John Whiting.
I know. Another break. What can I do? It's a promise to come back soon. As the man said, that was based on a short story by Ambrose Bierce, which was originally published in 1907, 6 years before he would die, or whatever happened to him. You know, some people say that if God did not exist, we'd have to create him. Well, I don't know about that, but I do believe that if Ambrose Bierce didn't exist, we'd have to create him. Although some say that Ambrose Bierce beat us to it. He was born in Ohio in 1842 to a family with a tendency towards eccentricity, to say the least. He had a brother, who we are told ran away with the circus, a sister who was supposedly eaten by cannibals. Ambrose himself served with great distinction in the Civil War to become a successful journalist in the West. By all accounts, he was a thoroughly unpleasant, cantankerous man. And his end, and he's probably more famous for his end than anything else, is one of those mysteries that is spoken of in pretty much the same breath as Amelia Earhart and Judge Roy Bean, all people who disappeared without a trace. All that anybody really knows about what happened to him is that in 1913 he went down into Mexico and was never heard from again. Not a peep. Whatever his personal foibles were, he was in fact a brilliant, brilliant writer. The Moonlit Road was not the greatest thing he ever wrote. In general, his ghost stories are considered seminal, and that they are unusually modern. Bierce has a reputation as being one of the first writers to bring the ghost story out of the Victorian county house. And the 20th century ghost story was to develop in a very different direction after his example. Later, we're going to hear a short story by the master. Well, you know, one of the masters of Victorian literature. Edgar Allan Poe's Shadow, a parable. It's interesting to compare the two in their use of language, although I guess, strictly speaking, Shadow, a parable, is not a ghost story. To tell you the truth, I'm not quite sure what it was. It must have been literature. But that's after this. This is a short story from the LibriVox Project by Robert Sheckley, called Cost of Living. You may have heard me go on and on and on with great enthusiasm about the talents of Robert Sheckley. A number of Sheckley's short stories have been adapted for radio and television, and film for that matter. One of the last successful adaptations of a Sheckley story was the really quite terrible Free Jack, which was based on a much better, much more entertaining book called Immortality Incorporated. Anyway, The Cost of Living was originally published in Galaxy Magazine for December of 1952 and is the very first Robert Sheckley story published anywhere.
Cost of Living by Robert Sheckley. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Tabithat. Cost of Living by Robert Sheckley. Heron decided that he could trace his present mood to Miller's suicide last week, but the knowledge didn't help him get rid of the vague, formless fear in the back of his mind. It was foolish. Miller's suicide didn't concern him. But why had that fat, jovial man killed himself? Miller had had everything to live for, wife, kids, good job, and all the marvellous luxuries of the age. Why had he done it? "Good morning, dear," Karen's wife said as he sat down at the breakfast table. "Morning, honey. Morning, Billy." His son grunted something. "You just couldn't tell about people," Karen decided, and dialed his breakfast. The meal was gracefully prepared and served by the new Avignon electric auto-cook. His mood persisted, annoyingly enough, since Karen wanted to be in top form this morning. was his day off, and the Avignon Electric Finance man was coming. This was an important day. He walked to the door with his son. "Have a good day, Billy." His son nodded, shifted his books, and started to school without answering. Karen wondered if something was bothering him, too. He hoped not. One worrier in the family was plenty. "See you later, honey," he kissed his wife as she left to go shopping. At any rate, he thought, watching her go down the walk, at least she's happy. He wondered how much she'd spend at the AE store. Checking his watch, he found that he had half an hour before the AE finance man was due. The best way to get rid of a bad mood was to drown it, he told himself, and headed for the shower. The shower room was a glittering plastic wonder, and the sheer luxury of it eased Karen's mind. He threw his clothes into the AE automatic clean presser and adjusted the shower spray to a notch above brisk. The 5 degrees above skin temperature water beat against his thin white body. Delightful. And then a relaxing rub dry in the AE auto towel. Wonderful, he thought, as the towel stretched and kneaded his stringy muscles. And it should be wonderful, he reminded himself. The AE auto towel with shaving attachments had cost $313 plus tax. But worth every penny of it, he decided, as the AE shaver came out of a corner and whisked off his rudimentary stubble. After all, what good was life if it couldn't enjoy the luxuries? His skin tingled when he switched off the auto towel. He should have been feeling wonderful, but he wasn't. Miller's suicide kept nagging at his mind, destroying the peace of his day off. Was there anything else bothering him? Certainly there was nothing wrong with the house. His papers were in order for the finance man. "Have I forgotten something?" he asked out loud. "The Avignon electric finance man will be here in 15 minutes," his AE bathroom wall reminder whispered. "I know that. Is there anything else?" The wall reminder reeled off its memorized data, a vast amount of minutiae about watering the lawn, having the jet lash checked, buying lamb chops for Monday and the like, things he still hadn't found time for. "All right, that's enough." He allowed the AE autodresser to dress him, skillfully draping a new selection of fabrics over his bony frame. A whiff of fashionable masculine perfume finished him, and he went into the living room, threading his way between the appliances that lined the walls. A quick inspection of the dials on the wall assured him that the house was in order. The breakfast dishes had been sanitized and stacked, the house had been cleaned, dusted, polished, his wife's garments had been hung up, his son's model rocket ships had been put back in the closet. "Stop worrying, you hypochondriac," he told himself angrily. The door announced, "Mr. Pathis from Avignon Finance is here." Karen started to tell the door to open when he noticed the automatic bartender. Good God, why hadn't he thought of it? The automatic bartender was manufactured by Castile Motors. He had bought it in a weak moment. AE wouldn't think very highly of that since they sold their own brand. He wheeled the bartender into the kitchen and told the door to open. "A very good day to you, sir," Mr. Pathis said. Pathis was a tall, imposing man dressed in a conservative tweed drape. His eyes had the crinkled corners of a man who laughs frequently. He beamed broadly and shook Karen's hand, looking around the crowded living room. "A beautiful place you have here, sir, beautiful. As a matter of fact, I don't think I'll be overstepping the company's code to inform you that yours is the nicest interior in this section." Karen felt a sudden glow of pride at that, thinking of the rows of identical houses in this block and the next and the one after that. "Now then, is everything functioning properly?" Mr. Pathis asked, setting his briefcase on a chair. "Everything in order?" "Oh, yes," Karen said enthusiastically. "Avignon Electric never goes out of whack." "The phone all right? Changes records for the full 17 hours?" "It certainly does," Karen said. He hadn't had a chance to try out the phone, but it was a beautiful piece of furniture. "The Solido projector all right? Enjoying the programs?" "Absolutely perfect reception." He'd watched a program just last month, and it had been startlingly lifelike. "How about the kitchen? Auto-cook in order? Recipe master still knocking them out?" "Marvellous stuff, simply marvellous." Mr. Pathis went on to inquire about his refrigerator, his vacuum cleaner, his car, his helicopter, his subterranean swimming pool, and the hundreds of other items Karen had bought from Avignon Electric. "Everything is swell," said Karen, a trifle untruthfully, since he hadn't unpacked every item yet. "Just wonderful." "I'm so glad," Mr. Pathis said, leaning back with a sigh of relief. "You have no idea how hard we try to satisfy our customers. If a product isn't right, back it comes, no questions asked. We believe in pleasing our customers. I certainly appreciate it, Mr. Pathis. Karen hoped the A.E. man wouldn't ask to see the kitchen. He visualized the Castile Motors bartender in there like a porcupine in a dog show. I'm proud to say that most of the people in this neighborhood buy from us, Mr. Pathis was saying. We're a solid firm. Was Mr. Miller a customer of yours? Karen asked. That fellow who killed himself? Pathis frowned briefly. He was, as a matter of fact. That amazed me, sir, absolutely amazed me. Why, just last month the fellow bought a brand new jet lash from me, capable of doing 350 miles an hour on a straightaway. He was as happy as a kid over it. And then to go and do a thing like that. Of course, the jet lash brought up his debt a little. Of course. But what did that matter? He had every luxury in the world. And then he went and hung himself. Hung himself? Yes, Pathis said, the frown coming back. Every modern convenience in his house, and he hung himself with a piece of rope. Probably unbalanced for a long time. The frown slid off his face, and the customary smile replaced it. But enough of that. Let's talk about you. The smile widened as Pathis opened his briefcase. Now then, your account. You owe us $203,000.29, Mr. Karen, as of your last purchase, right? Right, Karen said, remembering the amount from his own papers. Here's my instalment. He handed Pathis an envelope, which the man checked and put in his pocket. Fine. Now you know, Mr. Karen, that you won't live long enough to pay us the full $200,000, don't you? No, I don't suppose I will, Karen said soberly. He was only 39, with a full 100 years of life before him, thanks to the marvels of medical science. But at a salary of $3,000 a year, he still couldn't pay it all off and have enough to support a family on at the same time. Of course, we would not want to deprive you of necessities, which in any case is fully protected by the laws we help formulate and pass, to say nothing of the terrific items that are coming out next year, things you wouldn't want to miss, sir. Mr. Karen nodded. Certainly he wanted new items. Well, suppose we make the customary arrangement. If you will just sign over your son's earnings for the first 30 years of his adult life, we can easily arrange credit for you. Mr. Pathis whipped the papers out of his briefcase and spread them in front of Karen. If you'll just sign here, sir. Well, Karen said, I'm not sure. I'd like to give the boy a start in life, not saddle him with... But, my dear sir, Pathis interposed, this is for your son as well. He lives here, doesn't he? He has a right to enjoy the luxuries, the marvels of science. Sure, Karen said, only... Why, today, sir, the average man is living like a king. 100 years ago, the richest man in the world couldn't buy what any ordinary citizen possesses at present. You mustn't look upon it as a debt. It's an investment. That's true, Karen said dubiously. He thought about his son and his rocket ship models, his star charts, his maps. Would it be right? He asked himself. What's wrong? Pathis asked cheerfully. Well, I was just wondering, Karen said. Signing over my son's earnings, you don't think I'm getting in a little too deep, do you? Too deep, my dear sir, Pathis exploded into laughter. Do you know Mellon down the block? Well, don't say I said it, but he's already mortgaged his grandchildren's salary for their full life expectancy. And he doesn't have half the goods he's made up his mind to own. We'll work out something for him. Service to the customer is our job, and we know it well. Karen wavered visibly. And after you're gone, sir, they'll all belong to your son. That was true, Karen thought. His son would have all the marvellous things that filled the house. And after all, it was only 30 years out of a life expectancy of 150. He signed with a flourish. Excellent, Pathis said. And by the way, has your home got an A.E. master operator? It hadn't. Pathis explained that a master operator was new this year, a stupendous advance in scientific engineering. It was designed to take over all the functions of house cleaning and cooking without its owner having to lift a finger. Instead of running around all day pushing half a dozen different buttons, with a master operator all you have to do is push one, a remarkable achievement. Since it was only $535, Karen signed for one, having it added to his son's debt. Right's right, he thought, walking Pathis to the door. This house will be Billy's some day, his and his wife's. They certainly will want everything up to date. Just one button, he thought, that would be a time-saver. After Pather slept, Karen sat back in an adjustable chair and turned on the Solido. After twisting the easy dial, he discovered that there was nothing he wanted to see. He tilted back the chair and took a nap. The something on his mind was still bothering him. "Hello, darling," he awoke to find his wife was home. She kissed him on the ear. "Look." She had bought an A.E. Sexitizer negligee. He was pleasantly surprised that that was all she had bought. Usually Leela returned from shopping laden down. "It's lovely," he said. She bent over for a kiss, then giggled, a habit he knew she had picked up from the latest popular Solido star. He wished she hadn't. "Going to dial supper," she said, and went into the kitchen. Karen smiled, thinking that soon she would be able to dial the meals without moving out of the living room. He settled back in his chair, and his son walked in. "How's it going, son?" he asked heartily. "All right," Billy answered listlessly. "What's the matter, son?" The boy stared at his feet, not answering. "Come on, tell Dad what's the trouble." Billy sat down on a packing case and put his chin in his hands. He looked thoughtfully at his father. "Dad, could I be a master repairman if I wanted to be?" Mr. Karen smiled at the question. Billy alternated between wanting to be a master repairman and a rocket pilot. The repairmen were the elite. It was their job to fix the automatic repair machines. The repair machines could fix just about anything, but you couldn't have a machine fix the machine that fixed the machine. That was where the master repairmen came in. But it was a highly competitive field, and only a very few of the best brains were able to get their degrees, and although the boy was bright, he didn't seem to have an engineering bent. "It's possible, son. Anything's possible." "But is it possible for me?" "I don't know," Karen answered as honestly as he could. "Well, I don't want to be a master repairman anyway," the boy said, seeing that the answer was no. "I want to be a space pilot." "A space pilot, Billy?" Leela asked, coming into the room. "But there aren't any." "Yes, there are," Billy argued. "We were told in school that the government is going to send some men to Mars." "They've been saying that for 100 years, Karen said, "and they still haven't gotten around to doing it."
"They will this time."
"Why would you want to go to Mars?" Leela asked, winking at Karen. "There are no pretty girls on Mars."
"I'm not interested in girls. I just want to go to Mars."
"You wouldn't like it, honey," Leela said. "It's a nasty old place with no air."
"It's got some air."
"I'd like to go there," the boy insisted sullenly. "I don't like it here."
"What's that?" Karen asked, sitting up straight. "Is there anything you haven't got? Anything you want?"
"No, sir. I've got everything I want." Whenever his son called him sir, Karen knew that something was wrong.
"Look, son, when I was your age, I wanted to go to Mars, too. I wanted to do romantic things. I even wanted to be a master repairman."
"Then why didn't you?"
"Well, I grew up. I realized that there were more important things. First I had to pay off the debt my father had left me, and then I met your mother." Leela giggled. "And I wanted a home of my own. It'll be the same with you. You'll pay off your debt and get married the same as the rest of us."
Billy was silent for a while. Then he brushed his dark hair, straight like his father's, back from his forehead and wet his lips.
"How come I have debt, sir?"
Karen explained carefully about the things the family needed for civilized living and the cost of those items, how they had to be paid, how it was customary for a son to take on a part of his parents' debt when he came of age. Billy's silence annoyed him. It was almost as if the boy were reproaching him, after he had slaved for years to give the ungrateful whelp every luxury.
"Son," he said harshly, "have you studied history in school? Good. Then you know how it was in the past. Wars. How would you like to get blown up in a war?"
The boy didn't answer.
"Or how would you like to break your back for 8 hours a day doing work a machine should handle, or be hungry all the time, or cold with the rain beating down on you and no place to sleep?"
He paused for a response, got none, and went on. "You live in the most fortunate age mankind has ever known. You're surrounded by every wonder of art and science, the finest music, the greatest books and art, all at your fingertips. All you have to do is push a button." He shifted to a kindlier tone. "Well, what are you thinking?"
"I was just wondering how I could go to Mars," the boy said. "With the debt, I mean." I don't suppose I could get away from that. Of course not. Unless I stowed away on a rocket. But you wouldn't do that. No, of course not, the boy said, but his tone lacked conviction. You'll stay here and marry a very nice girl, Leela told him. Sure I will, Billy said. Sure. He grinned suddenly. I didn't mean any of that stuff about going to Mars. I really didn't. I'm glad of that, Leela answered. Just forget I mentioned it, Billy said, smiling stiffly. He stood up and raced upstairs. Probably gone to play with his rockets, Leela said. He's such a little devil. The Karens ate a quiet supper, and then it was time for Mr. Karen to go to work. He was on night shift this month. He kissed his wife goodbye, climbed into his jetlash, and roared to the factory. The automatic gates recognized him and opened. He parked and walked in. Automatic lathes, automatic presses, everything was automatic. The factory was huge and bright, and the machines hummed softly to themselves, doing their job and doing it well. Karen walked to the end of the automatic washing machine assembly line to relieve the man there. "Everything all right?" he asked. "Sure," the man said. "Haven't had a bad one all year. These new models have built-in voices. They don't light up like the old ones." Karen sat down where the man had sat and waited for the first washing machine to come through. His job was the soul of simplicity. He just sat there and the machines went by him. He pressed a button on them and found out if they were all right. They always were. After passing him, the washing machines went to the packaging section. The first one slid by on the long slide of rollers. He pressed the starting button on the side. "Ready for the wash," the washing machine said. Karen pressed the release and let it go by. That boy of his, Karen thought, would he grow up and face his responsibilities? Would he mature and take his place in society? Karen doubted it. The boy was a born rebel. If anyone got to Mars, it would be his kid. But the thought didn't especially disturb him. "Ready for the wash," another machine went by. Karen remembered something about Miller. The jovial man had always been talking about the planets, always kidding about going off somewhere and roughing it. He hadn't, though. He'd committed suicide. "Ready for the wash?" Karen had 8 hours in front of him, and he loosened his belt to prepare for it. 8 hours of pushing buttons and listening to a machine announce its readiness. "Ready for the wash?" He pressed the release. "Ready for the wash?" Karen's mind strayed from the job, which didn't need much attention in any case. He wished he'd done what he'd longed to do as a youngster. It would have been great to be a rocket pilot, to push a button and go to Mars.
Incredible, but true.
The spot where the O'Rourke family had lived for almost 100 years was known as Island McGee, and the long, narrow, hilly road that stretched between high thorn hedges to the nearby town bore the name of Nohed Lonin. Each Monday morning, it was Kathleen O'Rourke's custom to walk down the Lonin to the village post office. Since she started out at an early hour, the road was usually deserted. But on a certain morning in June, as she passed the cottage of her neighbor, Molly Donovan, she saw Molly standing at the gate beckoning to her.
Kathleen, you wouldn't be going for the post now, would you, darling?
Yes, I would, Molly.
And could you be doing a great favor for me while you're there now? It's my brother, Patrick. 3 months he's gone now, Kathleen, and not a word has he written me. And I'm that worried about him.
So you'd be wanting me to inquire at the post office if there's a letter waiting for you?
That's it. If it's not too much to be asking you.
It is nothing at all, Molly. Wait right here. I'll be back.
And Kathleen O'Rourke continued along the road. At the post office, she collected her family's mail, but the postmaster shook his head and said there was nothing for the Donovan household. And so Kathleen turned back toward home. And it was then, just after she'd passed the outskirts of the village and started up the Nohed Lonin, it was then that she saw the man. He was tall. She had a feeling that he was handsome. A few moments later, she stood at Molly Donovan's gate.
No word from the brother.
No word and nothing at all.
Oh, heaven help him. Now I am worried for sure.
But Kathleen O'Rourke did not stay to reassure her neighbor. She sped quickly on toward home. And only when she reached the top of the hill did she stop to look behind her.
Well, now, what do you know? I thought the lad was a stranger in these parts. But there he is, standing at the gate, talking to Molly Donovan.
It was not until the following Monday
when she passed by the Donovan cottage again that she had a chance to ask Molly a few questions.
Who was he now, Molly? The lad that was walking right behind me last Monday morning.
I saw no lad, Kathy.
How can you say that, Molly? You know yourself he stopped to talk to you.
It's mistaken ye are, lass. No one said a word to me that morning, besides yourself.
But I saw him with my own eyes. He was standing here at this gate.
If this is some joke you're playing, darling, you're picking a poor time for it. Sure, and my heart's too heavy even for that. 'Tis my brother, Padre. We heard last night. He's gone, darling. Washed overboard. Lost at sea. It happened early last Monday morning. He must have died just when you were running up Knowhead Loaning.
Yes, Molly Donovan's brother died at the very moment the strange young man appeared on the road behind Kathleen O'Rourke. And though Kathleen saw that man following after her, saw him stop at the gate and talk to Molly, Molly herself was unaware of his presence. This is only one of many such stories out of the country of Erra. A story incredible but true.
We think of the pioneers and trailblazers of the Old West as rugged and realistic men who would be not in the least concerned with such things as the meaning of visions and dreams. But out of California, during the colorful days when the wild scramble for gold was on, comes an authentic story of one such pioneer who was apparently unlike the rest. His name was Captain George Yount, and he was a man who believed in dreams.
It was in November of the year 1852 that Captain Yount accompanied old Henry Horn on a hunting trip. They sat one morning around the campfire that blazed outside their tent.
What's on your mind, George?
Oh, I wish I knew, Henry. Just a kind of feeling.
Your bulls are telling you there's snow in there. We was going to be up there in the mountains tonight. Might be something to worry about, but down
Henry,
here...
Henry, wait a minute. Snow and mountains, that's it. I dreamed about snow and mountains last night. It's coming back to me now, Henry. They were trapped up there in a Little Nell Pass. They were snowbound. A party of immigrants. There was eight of them. No, nine, including the young lad. Just a boy he was, and he was crying. I saw the pass as clear as I ever seen anything.
And Captain Yount did proceed to describe the mountain pass, just as he had seen it in his dream.
You darn fool, George. Oh, you darn fool. No wonder you seen that pass so clear. It's the Carson Valley Pass. You didn't make it up in your dream. You just remembered it, that's all.
I wouldn't know, Henry. You see, I've never been there.
Captain Yount's hunting luck was bad that day. His mind seemed to be on something other than hunting. And toward evening, as the two men made their way back to camp...
Henry, I'm heading back for town tonight. Organize a rescue party.
Well, who in tarnation you going to rescue?
Nine immigrants, snowbound, up in Carson Valley Pass.
George Yount, you lost your mind or something? That was a dream you had.
Maybe it was just a dream. Maybe not.
The captain and a small band of well-paid adventurers set out on horseback for the mountains. For 3 days they rode without seeing the slightest trace of the emigrant party. But as they approached Carson Valley Pass, the captain's mouth fell open in amazement. The snow piled at the treetops, the very path beneath his horse's feet, all were just as he had dreamed. And so the captain was scarcely surprised to find, on the morning of the fourth day, a boy of 16 standing guard at the mouth of the path.
That's him. That's the lad I saw crying in the snow.
But there were no tears in the boy's eyes now. Only joy and relief and unspeakable gratitude. And as Captain Yount leaned over him, the boy murmured through frozen lips.
The rest of them are back there in the past. There are just six, including myself.
Well, now that's strange. I could have sworn there were nine.
There were a few days ago, sir. But three of the men have died.
And so Captain Yount's dream was realized to the last detail. To those who are skeptical, one can only cite the words of Horace Bushnell, the foremost religious scholar and theologian of the last century, who said, "You need have no doubt of this story. We in California know the facts." And facts they remain. Facts which have never been satisfactorily explained. facts. Incredible, but true.
Okay, we got a little bit of a break here. Be right back. I said about half an hour ago we would have a short story from Edgar Allan Poe called Shadow, a Parable. Tell you the truth, I don't really remember if I mentioned the date earlier, so I'll mention it now. It was written in 1850. It's a very interesting, very short, only 7 minutes long, but you can, some people call it disorganized. But it is masterfully created and written. It is unique in both style and design, and no more than 1,300 words in length. It quickly creates an eerie atmosphere, conjuring with the dead, and then ending with the arrival of a multitude of beings.
Shadow, a Parable, by Edgar Allan Poe. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Sean Michael Hogan. Shadow, a Parable, by Edgar Allan Poe. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow. Psalm of David. Ye who read are still among the living, but I who write shall have long since gone my way into the region of shadows. For indeed strange things shall happen, and secret things be known, and many centuries shall pass away ere these memorials be seen of men. And when seen, there will be some to disbelieve, and some to doubt, and yet a few who will find much to ponder upon in the characters here graven with a stylus of iron. The year had been a year of terror, and of feelings more intense than terror, for which there is no name upon the earth. For many prodigies and signs had taken place, and far and wide, over sea and land, the black wings of the pestilence were spread abroad. To those nevertheless cunning in the stars, it was not unknown that the heavens wore an aspect of ill, and to me, the Greek Oinos, among others, it was evident that now had arrived the alternation of that 794th year when, at the entrance of Aries, the planet Jupiter is conjoined with the red ring of the terrible Saturnus. The peculiar spirit of the skies, if I mistake not greatly, made itself manifest, not only in the physical orb of the earth, but in the souls, imaginations, and meditations of mankind. Over some flasks of the red Chian wine, within the walls of a noble hall, in a dim city called Ptolemais, we sat at night a company of seven, and the door was fashioned by the artisan Korinos, and, being of rare workmanship, was fastened from within. Black draperies, likewise, in the gloomy room, shut out from our view the moon, the lurid stars, and the peopleless streets. But the boding and the memory of evil, they would not be so excluded. There were things around us and about of which I can render no distinct account, things material and spiritual, heaviness in the atmosphere, a sense of suffocation, anxiety, and above all that terrible state of existence which the nervous experience when the senses are keenly living and awake, and meanwhile the powers of thought lie dormant. A dead weight hung upon us. It hung upon our limbs, upon the household furniture, upon the goblets from which we drank, and all things were depressed and borne down thereby. All things save only the flames of the seven lamps which illumined our revel. Uprearing themselves in tall, slender lines of light, they thus remained burning, all pallid and motionless. And in the mirror which their luster formed upon the round table of ebony at which we sat, each of us there assembled beheld the pallor of his own countenance, and the unquiet glare in the downcast eyes of his companions. Yet we laughed, and were merry in our proper way, which was hysterical, and sang the songs of Anacreon, which are madness, and drank deeply, although the purple wine reminded us of blood. For there was yet another tenant of our chamber, in the person of young Zoilus. Dead, and at full length he lay, enshrouded, the genius and the demon of the scene. Alas! He bore no portion in our mirth, save that his countenance, distorted with the plague, and his eyes, in which death had but half extinguished the fire of the pestilence, seemed to take such interest in our merriment as the dead may haply take in the merriment of those who are about to die. But although I, Oinos, felt that the eyes of the departed were upon me, still I forced myself not to perceive the bitterness of their expression, and gazing down steadily into the depths of the ebony mirror, sang with a loud and sonorous voice the songs of the son of Teos. But gradually my songs they ceased, and their echoes, rolling afar off among the sable draperies of the chamber, became weak and undistinguishable, and so faded away. And lo, from among those sable draperies where the sounds of the song departed, there came forth a dark and undefined shadow, a shadow such as the moon, when low in heaven, might fashion from the figure of a man. But it was the shadow neither of man nor of God nor of any familiar thing. And quivering a while among the draperies of the room, it at length rested in full view upon the surface of the door of brass. But the shadow was vague and formless and indefinite, and was the shadow neither of man nor of God, neither God of Greece nor God of Chaldea nor any Egyptian god. And the shadow rested upon the brazen doorway and under the arch of the entablature of the door, and moved not, nor spoke any word, but there became stationary and remained. And the door whereupon the shadow rested was, if I remember aright, over against the feet of the young Zoilus enshrouded. But we, the seven there assembled, having seen the shadow as it came out from among the draperies, dared not steadily behold it, but cast down our eyes, and gazed continually into the depths of the mirror of ebony. And at length I, Oinos, speaking some low words, demanded of the shadow its dwelling and its appellation. And the shadow answered, I am Shadow, and my dwelling is near to the catacombs of Ptolemais, and hard by those dim plains of Halusion, which border upon the foul Charonian canal. And then did we, the seven, start from our seats in horror, and stand trembling and shuddering and aghast. For the tones in the voice of the shadow were not the tones of any one being, but of a multitude of beings, and, varying in their cadences from syllable to syllable, fell duskly upon our ears in the well-remembered and familiar accents of many thousand departed friends. End of Shadow, a Parable. Recording by Sean Michael Hogan, St. John's, Newfoundland, Canada.
Next up is a visit to the strange Dr. Weird in his house by the graveyard. It's an effort called When Killers Meet, and is from April the 17th of 1945. Enjoy.
The Strange Dr. Weird.
Good evening. Come in, won't you? What's the matter? You seem pale tonight. Perhaps you're working too hard. Suppose I tell you a story I've just heard that might relax you. It's about a killer who prided himself on being too clever to be caught, and what happened when he met another murderer who was equally clever. I call the story When Killers Meet. My story begins in a small Midwestern city. It is late afternoon, and two men are crouching in the shadows of an alley in the downtown section. They are Nick Randolph, clever jewel thief, and his companion, Mike Nelson, and they are being hunted by the police.
Nick, listen. Those patrol cars, they're all around us. Nick, we're trapped.
I'll get us out of it. Have I ever slipped up yet?
No, But you did this afternoon when you plugged that jeweler. Why did you have to kill him for?
Because he saw me substitute that phony diamond for the real one. His testimony could have sent us to the pen for 10 years.
Yeah, and now he's dead. And if we are caught, we get the rope instead.
A dead witness can't testify, and we're not going to be caught. Once we get hold of a car, I know every back road around here. I got us onto one where they'll never dream of looking for us.
Yeah? And where are we going to get a car?
We're going to have one inside of 1 minute. Look at that guy walking this way. He's taking keys out of his pocket. He's going to unlock that car parked there at the end of the alley.
Yeah. Here he is stopping. It's his car, all right.
Come on, follow me. I'll handle this.
Okay, Nick.
Oh, excuse me, sir.
Eh? What is it? A gun. What is this, a hold-up?
Not exactly. Call it an emergency borrowing.
Yeah. I can't.
All right, Mike, pick up his keys. We're on our way. Well, Mike, you getting your confidence in me back yet?
All right, Nick, I admit it. You got what it takes.
I've never been caught, never been jailed, Mike. Why? Because I'm too clever. No witness has ever testified against me. I've never left a possible witness alive. See?
Yeah. Yeah, I see, Nick. What's the next move?
This road will take us out of the state in another hour. We have to go through a couple of villages, but nobody will stop. They're not looking for us here. Besides, it'll be dark in 20 minutes. Suppose you turn on the radio. There might be some news.
Okay. Just time for the news, too.
There's the invasion. And now, please, attention, everyone. Attention, everyone. Be on the lookout for two men fleeing the state in a stolen black sedan. These two men are wanted for the hold-up murder of John A. Smith in Central City this afternoon.
Nick, they know about the car.
Please take down this license number. K370154. K370154. That is the license number of the stolen car in which the killers are.
They got the license number too, Nick.
Shut up, Mike.
The owner, now in City Hospital, near death from a bullet wound, reports that the left headlight of the stolen car is burned out. So if you see a black sedan with only one headlight, report it at once to the nearest authorities. And now, back to you.
Blast the luck. I should have fed him more slugs. Then he wouldn't have done any talking.
That's bad. What are we going to do now, Nick?
Well, first, let's make sure about that headlight. I'll turn it on. Yeah, left one is burned out. Well, that means we've got to get another car, or they'll nab us sure.
Well, how are we going to get another buggy way out here in the country?
I'll tell you how. Look, up there on top of that hill ahead of us.
Huh? A bungalow with lights in the window. Yeah, and a car parked in the yard.
That's the car we're going to get. And nobody's going to know we have it because we're going to make dead sure there isn't a living soul left in that bungalow to tell about it.
Hardly 2 minutes later, the two men stopped their car in the driveway outside the little bungalow and stared with hard eyes toward the brightly lighted windows.
Well, here we are. See anyone out?
No. Everybody must be inside. What's our play?
We'll go up and knock, pretend we've lost our way. Get inside, then make sure we have everybody in the house spotted.
And then we start blasting, huh?
That's right. And this time there'll be no slip-up. Okay, let's go.
Nick and Mike strode up the gravel path and knocked on the door of the bungalow. The little man, whose face was twisted by horror and remorse, opened it for them, and then startled them by crying
out. You're here. Thank heaven you came so quick.
What?
Sheriff, what do you mean, Sheriff?
Sheriff, I didn't mean to do it. I really didn't mean to do it.
Nick, what's the guy talking about?
Here, Sheriff, take it. Please take it. It's a poker I killed her with.
A bloodstained poker?
She's been nagging at me all day, telling me what a failure I was. How sorry she was she ever married me. And then I hit her. She fell and there was blood all over.
Say, what is this, Nick?
Mike, look.
Good grief. It's a woman. Lying on the floor at the foot of the stairs. And there's blood all over her hair and on the floor beside her head.
Yeah, don't you get it? We've stumbled onto a murder. This little punk has just killed his wife.
Doctor, with all your experience, what is the first thing you notice about people?
Whether they're living or dead.
Well, that does make a difference, doesn't it? And you know, Doctor, I notice the same thing, only with hats, not people. Some hats look alive. Some are dead. A hat that stays lively and in fine shape a long time after it's been bought will naturally make the rest of your clothes look worlds better. A colorless and dead-looking hat can kill the good effect of even the most fashionable apparel. Hats can make a difference. Gentlemen, wear a smart-looking hat that will keep its shape and help you look your best. Wear an Adam hat. They are made of fine quality material, tailored and blocked in the latest styles. And an Adam will fit your head perfectly. You're not always tugging at the brim and adjusting the crown. Remember the name, Adam. An Adam hat does make a difference. Now, back to the strange Dr. Weird.
And now I'll continue my story, When Killers Meet. For a minute, Nick Randolph and Mike Nelson, startled by stumbling onto a murder in the very house where they had planned to eliminate all the residents and steal another getaway car, could only stare at the dead woman lying in the hall and at the little man blurting out his pitiful confession.
I didn't mean to kill her. I didn't, I tell you, I didn't.
Then brutally, Nick grabbed the little man and shook him.
Listen to me. You hear? Listen to me.
Sheriff.
What's your name?
Harry Williams. But I told you that over the phone just now when I...
Yeah, I know, but now let me get this straight, Williams. Your wife's been nagging you all day. So just now you hit her with a poker, is that it?
Yeah, I just couldn't stand her nagging me anymore. Something in me snapped, but I didn't mean I didn't.
Now get control of yourself. You say you telephoned the sheriff 20 minutes ago?
Yeah, but aren't you the sheriff?
No, I'm not the sheriff. I was just passing, see? The sheriff will be here in a minute. Now, you sit down and wait for him.
Wait for him?
Yes, I'll stop in town to make sure that he's coming. Now, you go back in and sit down.
Go back and sit down?
Yes, yes, that's right.
All right, did you say...
Nick, what is this?
Don't you understand? This guy's a murderer. The sheriff and his deputies will be here any second. We've got to get away from this place, but fast.
But, Nick, I still don't get it. Why didn't we bump him off? Why didn't we even take his car?
Because we didn't have the time, you dummy. Don't you see he'd committed a murder? He'd sent for the cops. If we'd hung around even a minute more, we might have bumped into him.
Yeah, and that's the last thing we want to do now, to bump into any cops.
As it is, with the sheriff hustling out there to pick up this Williams guy, he won't be thinking of us. We can get into the next town, maybe pick up another car there. But one place we had to get away from fast was that house back there with that dead woman in it.
Sure, I see that now. And, Nick, if I... Nick, look, down the road. A car pulled right across the road. And a bunch of guys with rifles.
A trap. Well, we're not stopping. We're not going to be caught.
Yeah, what are we going to do?
I'll swing around it. I'll hit the ditch. Hold on. Here we go.
Nick, they're shooting at us.
Well, hang on. We're going to make it.
No! No, 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 Nick, that's me. We're going to hit it.
A few minutes later, the local sheriff was interviewing little Harry Williams, whose murder of his wife had thrown such a monkey wrench into Nick Randolph's plans.
Now, Mr. Williams, I'd like to get this whole story straight, if you don't mind.
Well, you see, Sheriff, I was sitting here in the living room with Nancy, that's my wife, listening to the radio, when the broadcast came on warning everybody to watch for the two men in the sedan with one burned-out headlight.
Yeah?
And that instant, they happened to look out the window there. Way down the road, I saw the single headlight of a car blink on for a moment.
I get you. Go on, Mr. Williams.
Well, I realized it must be the two killers in that car. And I knew they might decide to stop and take my car. Now, if they did, I was sure they killed both Nancy and myself, so we couldn't warn anybody.
Right. Why they didn't do it, I still don't know.
Well, you see, Sheriff, it's like this. Nancy is recovering from a broken leg, so we couldn't run out of the house and hide.
Yeah?
Yet, if we stayed here, the two killers might murder us. I had to think fast because it was a very tight bunch.
I'll say it was.
So I quickly carried Nancy out and put her down on the hall floor. I told her to play dead. Then I emptied a bottle of ketchup on the floor and her hair to look like blood.
Yeah.
Now, when those two killers knocked on the door half a minute later, I opened it and pretended to be a man who had just killed his wife in a sudden rage.
Holy smoke.
Yeah, I told them I just murdered Nancy and phoned you to come at once. They thought Nancy was really dead and that you and your men were actually on the way. So they turned right around and got away from here just as fast as they could.
Well, I'll be darned.
You see, I figured to myself, when a killer is trying to escape, the one individual he most wants to avoid is another murderer whom the police are closing in on.
Yeah?
And they were so anxious to give me a wide berth that they never even touched me. As soon as they left, I phoned you. You set the trap for them. Yeah, well, I guess everything worked out pretty well.
Why, it worked out perfect. Say, Williams, with an imagination like yours, you ought to be a detective story writer.
Well, to tell you the truth, Sheriff, that's just what I am.
That's what happens when one killer meets another. He gives him as wide a berth as possible. Only, of course, poor Nick was fooled. Harry Williams wasn't really a murderer at all. Now, what would have happened if, instead of being just a make-believe killer, little Harry had really been the real thing? Do you suppose that... Oh, you're leaving now. I'm sorry. I hope you'll drop in again soon. Just look for the house on the other side of the cemetery. The house of Dr. Weir.
Okay, that's it. The end of the dramatic presentation portion of Night Transmissions. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm just going to play 10 minutes or so of music here. I'm just going to say goodnight now and hope that you come back next week and invite you to drop by the website for the show notes. There are things at the website that might interest you, including this week some PDF files that relate to the stories, and who knows what else you might find.
Delia, oh Delia, Delia all my life. If I hadn't shot poor Delia, I'd have had her for my wife. Delia's gone, one more round, Delia's gone. I went up to Memphis, and I met Delia there. Found her in her parlor, and I tied her to her chair. Delia's gone, one more round, Delia's gone. She was low down and trifling, and she was cold and mean. Kind of evil make me want to grab my submachine. Delia's gone, one more round, Delia's gone. First time I shot her in the side. Hard to watch her suffer, but with the second shot she died. Delia's gone, one more round, Delia's gone. But jailer, oh jailer, jailer I can't sleep. Cause all around the bedside I hear the patter of Delia's feet. Delia's gone, one more round, Delia's gone. So if your woman's devilish, you can let her run, or you can bring her down and do her like Delia got done. Delia's gone, one more round, Delia's gone. Delia's gone, one more round, Delia's gone. Thank you.
tripping on the escalator. Every man in the line, and she's blowing his mind, thinking that he's already made her. Coming in Los Angeles, bringing in a couple of keys. Don't touch my bags if you please, Mr. Customs Man.
Texas town of El Paso, I fell in love with a Mexican girl. Nighttime would find me in Rose's Cantina, music would play and Felina would whirl. Blacker than night were the eyes of Felina, wicked and evil while casting a spell. My love was deep for this Mexican maiden. I was in love, but in vain I could tell. One night a wild young cowboy came in, wild as the West Texas wind. Dancing and daring, a drink he was sharing with wicked Felina, the girl that I love. So in anger I challenge his right for the love of this maiden. Down went his hand for the gun that he wore. My challenge was answered in less than a heartbeat. A handsome young stranger lay dead on the floor. Just for a moment I stood there in silence, shocked by the foul evil deed I had done. Many thoughts raced through my mind as I stood there. I had but one chance, and that was to run. Out through the back door of Roses I ran, out where the horses were tied. I caught a good one, it looked like it could run. Up on its back and away I did ride, just as fast as I could, from the West Texas town of El Paso, out to the badlands of New Mexico. Back in El Paso, my life would be worthless. Everything's gone in life, nothing is left. It's been so long since I've seen the young maid. My love is stronger than my fear of death. I saddle up and away I did go, riding alone in the dark. Maybe tomorrow a bullet may find me. Tonight nothing's worse than this pain in my heart. And at last here I am on the hill overlooking El Paso. I can see Rose's Cantina below. My love is strong and it pushes me onward. Down off the hill to Felina I go. Off to my right I see five mounted cowboys. Off to my left, right, a dozen or more. Shouting and shooting, I can't let them catch me. I have to make it to Rose's back door. Something is dreadfully wrong, for I feel a deep burning pain in my soul. Though I am trying to stay in the saddle, I'm getting weary, unable to ride. But my love for the leader is strong, and I rise where I fall. Though I am weary, I can't stop to rest. I see the white puff of smoke from the rifle. I feel the bullet go deep in my chest. From out of nowhere, Felina has found me, kissing my cheek as she kneels by my side. Cradled
goodbye to love in arms that I'll die for. One little kiss and goodbye.